Hello and welcome to episode 16 of Crate and Crowbar, being recorded on the 30th of October. I'm Marsh Davis and I'm very hungover. I'm joined by equally, if not more hungover people, Graham Smith.
Hello.
Tom Senior.
What?
And Tom Francis.
Hello.
Well done, gentlemen, for surviving the previous evening.
Yeah.
What have you been playing, guys?
Should we briefly explain why you're all hungover? It was a colleague's leaving drinks, and so people drank.
In the loudest pub. Like, my voice is fucked.
I don't remember it being loud, but I do remember partly losing my voice halfway through a conversation and not quite understanding why.
Why is this happening?
Screaming at Rich Santa about Steel Battalion for 20 minutes.
Yeah, so apologies. This podcast might not be its usual energetic... verve-filled self.
It hasn't stopped us drinking again now.
No,
we're gin and tonics.
Yeah. Fix things, I think.
Tonic is you know, an old English remedy for curing it. I'm much less hungry than you guys because I left earlier, I think.
Sensible man.
And I've been playing Eldritch, which is a first-person Lovecraftian horror thing. I believe Chris has talked about it before. But it's a roguelike, and quite interesting in that there aren't, I'm struggling to think of any other first-person roguelikes. Like, it's pretty, the convention of mashing roguelike stuff into more accessible game forms is fairly recent itself. And then, like, random level generation in 3D is also fairly recent, you know, Minecraft and stuff. And this is the first game I've played where it's, you know, doing all those things at once. And it's really interesting. It's got destructible terrain like Minecraft, but much harder to destroy terrain, a bit like Spelunky. You know, you need special tools in case you want to just, like, blow a hole in the wall. You need some dynamite, and that's a really scarce resource. But it's got, I think it's maybe, I can't decide if it's undermined by this or not, but it has a kind of hub mechanic. So it has very high penalty for death, but it's not really permadeath. You start in a library, and you unlock books, and each book takes you to a different, like, world, and each world has, like, four or five levels. And then at the end of it, you go back to the library, and you've unlocked the next book, and then you go to that other world. And if you die, you return to the library, but all those books are still unlocked. So if you're on chapter two, then, or book two, then when you die, you're still on book two, but you have no items anymore. So you've lost all of your, like, mana, which is artifacts, which is also the currency, bullets, any spells you had in, like, all your possessions. And that has this slightly unfortunate consequence that, like, the best thing to do then is not to go back to where you died and try that world again. It's really to go back to the start, because the start's really easy, and there's just loads of stuff lying around. Like, the start of the first book, there's just a compass lying on the ground always, even though the rest of the level is random. And the compass is incredibly useful. It tells you where the exit is. So it seems to me that you pretty much every time you die, you should go back to the first world, pick up that compass at least, and then go back to the library and then go back into the world. But also, if you really wanted to be in the best situation, I think I would just go through and complete World 1 again, which feels like... Right now, I mean, I haven't really done it yet. I haven't actually tried redoing all of Book 1, but it feels like it would be boring. Like, I don't really want to. I kind of feel like, I've done that now, I want to move on to the next world, but I can't because I lost all my stuff, so I've got to go back and get all my stuff again.
What's the difference between that and Spelunky's method of doing it, where you can give items to the Tunnel Man and he digs you shortcuts to World 2, but if you start on World 2, then you don't get the advantages of all the stuff you would have gathered by that point?
Yeah, it's Spelunky, you have the same problem as Spelunky. If you start on the Temple World through shortcuts and you have no items, then you're kind of boned.
Yeah.
I don't use the Tunnel Man in Spelunky. It's a good way of kind of practicing the next worlds, but it's not a good way of actually playing the game. But here, I don't know if it's the... I think Spelunky is a game about jumping and randomly generating the tiles, randomly placing where the land and the air and the spikes are, creates new jumping poles every time. So every time you play it, you're like, ah, how do I get across those spikes? How do I jump? Can I make that jump? Can I get down there? Do I need to use a bomb here? Whereas in Eldritch, it's just a space with some enemies in it. And since the enemies are the same each time, it's still just, oh, there's an enemy sneaking around, like walking around. I should sneak past him or I should stab him. And that decision maybe depends on your resources a bit, but it's pretty much the same decision every time. It's just the challenge doesn't seem to change. And like I said, I haven't, like, gone through and replayed all of Book 1. The levels are very different, so, like, visually they look different. But I feel like the challenge is still just there's a bunch of enemies roaming around, try and get past them if you can. I do really enjoy it, though. It's a very strange mix of stuff. Because it feels like an action game at first, because the first book you can just storm through and just, like, the basic knife will kill anything in one hit in the first world, except for a shot-off, which is a very rare thing that I think I only saw one of them in the first time I played it. And then I think the gun kills most things in one hit as well, and there's just loads of keys and ammo and food and stuff just lying around all over the place. And it feels like a sort of, you know, those, like, recharge rooms you get before a boss in a game where, like, you can tell, hey, there's loads of ammo and money and stuff, this must be, like, coming up to a hard challenge. It's like that, but there's no hard challenge.
Right.
And I didn't actually mind that, really. I know it was quite nice to just get a hang of the controls and figure out what this game's about doing that. And then World 2 is suddenly, like, 300 times harder. Like, two basic enemy types are, as far as I can tell, indestructible. Can never die.
Has this been tweaked, then, over the last few weeks? Have they patched this? Because I remember when Chris reviewed it, his criticism was that playing through it initially was very easy. The whole game is easy, and then you get unlock a new game plus kind of mode, which is actually kind of true way to play it.
I don't know if it's changed since then, but it does. I remember hearing early on from like people playing in alpha access that it was too hard at one point. So I think they made it easier, and then maybe they made it too easy, and maybe now they're compensated again. But I mean, once you understand how the enemies work, World 2 is not that hard to get through. It's just it suddenly switches from a game where you kill everything to a game where you simply can't kill things, so you just have to hide all the time. And I think, like, one of the enemy types that I never killed probably can be killed. I just didn't know how. They're statues, and when you're looking at them, they're made of solid rock, and no amount of damage seems to hurt them. And then when you're not looking at them, they instantly are behind you, killing you. And so it's tricky to go up. I guess probably throwing dynamite at them might kill them. And then there's another type that just always comes back when you kill it, so it just keeps on rising from the dead. And again, there's probably a way to take it down eventually. But yeah, just change genre, basically, from an action game to a stealth game. And I like that. And now I'm on World 3, or Book 3, and it's sort of, I think this one might be easier than I'm finding it. I think I'm trying to play it like World 2, and I think maybe each world is actually its own little game, and like the first one is kill everything, the second one is hide from everything, and the third one I think is probably kill everything again. And I've been hiding from everything, because it looks big and scary, and I'm just like, oh my god, that's a fucking star spawn, which is like a huge humanoid thing with a tentacle mouth like Cthulhu. And then there's these hideous, like, flying things that are just like a mouth and an eyeball, like, squishing and this lump. And, I've been hiding from them. But I think what I should be doing, as I died several times and I just kind of gave up on that world, so I need to go back to it. But what I'll do when I go back, I think, is try and kill everything. And, not loot it. Because it has this really interesting mechanic where if you kill something and you loot it, it will respawn somewhere fairly soon, like you'll be encountering that same enemy in the same world. And exploring the levels is the challenge, really. It's like just trying to get to the exit or trying to get all the loot on a level before you go on to the next level, the next kind of floor of the level. And that's difficult because there are enemies all over the place. But if you killed things and then you didn't loot them, they would stay there. So you could progressively clear out the whole place and actually make it safe. And then you'd have time to go around and find all of the stuff lying around. And there's loads of stuff lying around, probably more stuff than there is on the bodies of the enemies. So I'm starting to think that might be how you're supposed to do it, or that might be a good way to do Book 3. And I don't know if that's it. If there's in the library, you can only see three books, but then like once you've... There's this other place with like a mysterious door and three pedestals, and I think maybe after you unlock all of them, you get to some other further place. But yeah, so I don't know how long it's going to be. So far I've played it for 90 minutes, so... All of that stuff takes place pretty quickly.
Chris would be the person to ask when he's not here.
I don't need to know. I'm just. but I recommend it, even though it's got some balance problems. It's just really cool to play a roguelike in first person with, you know, like knives and guns and shit.
What about the Lovecraft elements? Like, I've only looked at it briefly in videos and that kind of thing, and it doesn't strike me as being Lovecrafted. I don't know why. I expect it's.
I think it's all Lovecraft monsters, but they're rendered in a very kind of cute style. It's very cartoonish and very silly. And I kind of like that. It's very, like, unselfconscious. They don't seem to realise that their art style is really cute, so they kind of, like, it is a horror game, and you're meant to be scared of these things, but also they look slightly ridiculous. There's the little fishmen who walk around who are kind of a bit pathetic. Like, in the world I'm in at the moment, they just beat their heads against the wall, and so they're easy to avoid and don't pose much threat. And I was going back to World 1 to kind of pick up some loot, and because I just died, I had nothing. And you can pick up certain objects like that aren't weapons necessarily, like rocks and bottles and things. And so I had a rock in my hand, and a fish man had just seen me. And I never really bothered fighting them before, so I just threw the rock, like trying to throw it over him to kind of distract him somehow, but it just hit him in the face and just killed him. Just instantly killed him. And that's hilarious. And I think maybe when you get to, in harder situations, throwing rocks to distract people and that kind of sort of systematic stuff is probably more of an element. I've already had one really cool moment where, you have, as well as your weapons, you have special abilities, like magic abilities, and you can only have one spell at a time, and you get them from shrines, but the location of the shrines is random, and lots of people they give you is random. So you can find, like, I think any spell on World 1, and I had found, like, a spell that lets you create blocks, so like Minecraft, kind of placing a cube, but you can't destroy them unless you have some other way of, like, dynamite or something. So you can completely trap yourself if you use it wrong. But you can sort of block off enemies and things, or use it to climb up to higher heights. I had one that lets you charm an enemy so they fight for you for a while. I had one that cloaks you. One that creates a distraction or unlocks a door, which is weird. But then the best one I found was just teleport, and it just fires a little thing out, and wherever it hits, your next click will teleport you there. And the end of World 2 featured those statue things. The first thing I did in World 2 was, like, saw a statue, ran up to it, was like, oh, the statue's gonna come alive, I know how games work, and start stabbing it with my knife, like, ha ha, stupid statue. And then, turned around from it, and then immediately lost all of my health, and, like, freaked out, looked back at it, and it was right behind me in a kind of attacking pose. And then I tried to figure out a way to get behind a wall so that it wouldn't be able to follow me, but as soon as I did that, it killed me. From then on, I was just like, don't ever fuck with the statues, don't even look at them, like, get away from them. If one of them ever sees you, you're just dead, because I can't see any way out of the situation. And then the end of that world is just a corridor of, like, 20 statues all facing the corridor, and the exit right at the end. And I was like, oh, shit. And then I thought, hang on, I have teleport. And just teleported, like, straight to the exit and just went straight through it. And Chris was telling me he had the same situation, but he had the Amulet of Destruction, which means bullets damage the scenery. And so he went to the floor above, and then just shot down, like, 10 times and burrowed through the ceiling and dropped onto the exit that way.
Clever stuff.
Yeah.
I do think, I think this game gets away with using Lovecraft again because it does that subversive thing of making it look cute. But I kind of feel that that's kind of that reappropriation of Lovecraft as something kind of almost cutesy and fetishistic because it kind of destroyed it as a mythos. Like, I mean, part of what's good about Lovecraft is that it's about the unknown and kind of unknowable, and yet it's become plushies and I think that's it's kind of made it toothless. I think in a game that was trying to seriously recreate Lovecraft or any of the fear or horror of Lovecraft, I think they would really struggle now because nobody can really take it seriously. How do you feel?
I'd like to see people looking at other horror authors and other horror concepts like Kafka or something like that, you know, games riffing on Kafka. That'd be crazy. More sources. It's like in the way that Aliens is kind of inspired so much action game, so many action game tropes. People like all the horror tropes coming from Cthulhu and from Lovecraft. So as you diversify that, you get more interesting worlds. One hopes. Stuff that's shit like The Void. Really weird places like The Void. Have you guys played The Void?
No, what's that?
The Void is first person game in which you're trapped in kind of a horrible purgatorial realm of connected islands, floating in space, inhabited by, these enormous, horrific creatures. One's just a giant wheel made of arms, and they're called the Brothers, and they think you're one of them, but you're not. So you're kind of, their job is to suck colour out of the world, and, colour is life, so you have to keep, cultivating colour. You plant trees that bloom colour, and then you suck it up, and that sustains you for a bit. But it's always gradually being sucked out of you by this horrendous kind of purgatorial realm around you.
This is a game?
This is a game, yeah.
What perspective?
First person.
Oh, wow, okay. Is this recent?
Is it by the guys that did Pathology? Yeah. Is it Ice Pick Lodge?
That's right, yeah. It's them, those guys. It's extremely difficult, and it's kind of supposed to be, actually. They've got a question later on about this kind of thing, where something I initially assumed was really bad game design actually turn out to be cultivating exactly the right sort of mental state. One of frustration and knowledge that you're imminently going to die and it's not entirely your fault. It's just the brutality of the world around you. It's like you're supposed to feel like that. You're supposed to be a nasty experience. But it's also quite horrifying as well. So you're kind of trying to pass yourself off as one of these horrendous brother creatures. And they start getting suspicious of you. And as soon as they realise, then you can fucking eat you or something, I don't know.
have you played Pathologic?
No, I haven't yet.
Because it's similarly, like, really clunky to look at and quite clunky to control, and its interface and stuff are terrible, but it's a first-person game where you are, like, you know, Eastern European influenced, and you're the son. You're a doctor returning back to the village you grew up in because your father is dying or has just died.
Yeah.
And the town's being destroyed by this plague. And it's just kind of got a real atmosphere of dread, essentially. Of just
nice.
Yeah.
Juicy, lovely dread.
Nothing quite makes sense. It's slightly surreal and everybody hates you. And it's just really interesting and hard to explain.
Yeah, that sounds good. I think that's the best kind of horror, is horror games where the thing that which is horrific is not like a creature or a thing, but a sense that reality itself is somehow sick. You know,
I think that's what
makes. Who's the horror author that Tony Ellis, PC Gamer's Predator, likes?
He likes a bit of
H.P. Lovecraft.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, I can't remember the name of him. He wrote the Stains, amongst other things, which is, if you Google it, a amazing short story. About moss, basically.
Moss.
Yeah.
Evil
but,
moss.
Yeah, all of that guy's stories, I'm fucking annoyed, I can't remember the name of the author, but all of his stories are just, there's not necessarily like an obvious antagonist or even an obvious point of origin for the evil that permeates them, but it's just this sense of just horrible nausea about reality, that there's something just off and wrong and decaying and corrupt about it.
It's so good. This morning.
Yeah, this is
a similar kind of feeling.
How I feel right now.
Speaking of horror, this isn't game related, but, well, it's vaguely game related. One of the artists from Gone Home, Emily Carroll, has just released a new horror comic called Out of Skin. And I haven't finished reading it, I was reading it on the way here on my phone, and I'm on like part 5 or something, and I'm dying to get back to it because it's fucking horrible.
Oh, awesome.
It's really nasty.
Sounds great.
Talking of purgatorial experiences, you've been playing Batman.
Smooth transition.
Gotham is a kind of weird purgatory, isn't it? I often wonder, playing the Arkham games, why anyone would become a police officer in that world. Why anyone would choose to live there in this disgusting, grey, horrible, crime-ridden, shit-stained cityscape.
What's weird about Arkham Origins, is that what it's called? I've forgotten
it's
that.
It's the new one, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, is that it's like all the events that appear in the earlier games, which are set later, that turn it into this horrible shit place, have seemingly already happened in the prequel. Like, it's just as bad in Arkham Origins.
Batman Arkham Origins is set 2 years after Batman becomes Batman, so it's not even an origin story of any kind. And you also start with all of the gear that you end Arkham City with.
What?
Plus you have a fucking Batplane, which you don't have in the previous games.
He just loses that. So,
it's a sequel. It's got all the escalation of a sequel, but it's actually a prequel, which doesn't make much sense.
Is it about the origins of Arkham?
No. Arkham is not mentioned. The word Arkham is not said in the game.
But it is set at 00 on the axes of the world, so technically is it the origin?
Maybe that is it. It's kind of odd. So they've added almost nothing to the first two games. They've added like a whole different section of city. But what they've done is they've added a warehouse district.
Imagination run wild, guys. You've got a free reign with this series.
We'll make a warehouse district.
With sewers underneath, I hope.
Oh, yeah, there are lots of sewers underneath. Yeah. No. Lots of sewers. And there's kind of the ways in which they've tried to add new things to it are faintly absurd and don't make sense. So you've got glue bombs now, and you use glue bombs. So there are these pipes that are venting out hot gas. And the only way to turn them off is with glue bombs, obviously. So you throw glue bombs at the opening and then that globs them shut. That actually, Metroid style, gets in new areas.
Globbed shut by Batman.
The weirdest
Batman's bit. Glue bombs.
So there's a really annoying bit in the previous game where you're on a slab of ice and you're grappling onto rings and tugging this piece of ice around to the ground. It's fucking annoying. It doesn't make any sense. Like physics of it doesn't
make
any sense.
Yeah, because you basically fly.
Only now they do that in sewers. But you create a raft using your glue bomb to make raft. And it's like, what happened to me, Batman? I'm supposed to be this creature of the night. What am I doing throwing glue bombs into fucking sewage water to get across ring across to a different part of another sewer?
Have you played the challenge mode?
Not for the new one. I played them to death for the old.
Yeah, because that's what I keep going back to with Arkham City in particular, is just playing challenge arenas again and again, and just the combat ones, not the stealth ones.
Yeah.
Just put me in a room with like 20 dudes. And then I'll see how fluidly I can take them all out. And doing that, like not even the hard ones, but it's just like the first sort of three of them are really easy. And so I just do those again and again, but trying to get like the absolute perfect crew flow thing where there's a bonus for not getting hurt in one round, there's a bonus for not getting hurt in all rounds put together, there's a bonus for doing one round in one long continuous combo without ever being interrupted or stopping, and there's another bonus for doing every round in one long combo each. So like there's five rounds of about like, you know, 10 guys and 20 guys and 30 guys and 50 guys, and you can do it in like five combos. You just like the last one, you just take out 50 people one after the other.
Yeah, it's still, because it's the copy of the combat system Wholesale.
Right.
Only they've added giant electric fist gloves, that you...
Are they giant?
They when they light up, these hands start smoking. You get this kind of physics smoke that comes out of them. It's very impressive. But then you power them up by punching people. So the action of punching people powers up the batteries
in your... My fists are powered by punching.
And then...
It's the only way to charge them!
Yeah, but except for, like, these puzzle generators where you come across them and you sort of grab them like this, you go, and kind of, you hug your hands around heart-shaped kind of dynamos and power them up, and that opens a door.
This is another one of the new things. It's
really weird.
Batman, the world's greatest detective.
They're punched to charge my power gloves.
And once they're charged, you press and click in both sticks to turn them on, and then they're effective against everything because they're giant smoking death fists. But it kind of removes all the kind of finery of the combat system.
Oh yeah, where you had to like do certain moves to counteract like a knife or counteract a stun stick or a shield or a...
So you'd have someone with a shield and you'd have to cape swipe them and then press A to jump up and then kind of elbow them on the top of the head. Or the knife guys where you have to hold down the block button and let go at the right moment to dodge back.
Don't ever fucking do that, by the way. Yes, I studied Arkham City's and Arkham Asylum's combat at great length, and don't ever fucking try and do that. Yeah. It doesn't fucking work.
Always
it's like almost impossible to pull off, and all you need to do is jump over them, and then you can hit them from behind, and they're not stabbing you.
There's a brilliant kind of, the old bone break move where, you know, you get your combo to a certain size, the combo meter catches fire, and that's when you know that you can. Yeah, so the number of hits kind of goes yellow and catches fire. That's when
I can't read it, but it's on fire now, so I'm guessing it's a lot.
And then you press two buttons to tackle someone to the ground and break their arm, and there's a brilliant cracking sound, and that's really satisfying. But
are you talking about the series in general?
The series in general, so that's the same again. But talk to people who are really obsessed with challenge mode. Apparently, they've broken combat slightly. I haven't really tried the challenge rooms. But the rhythm of the combat apparently is shanked it. It's kind of doesn't work correctly. It doesn't feel as responsive.
It used to be that the longer your combo had gone on for, the more acrobatic your character became. And so if you hit attack and there's no one inside 20 feet, then normally you just punch and you miss and then you break the combo and it's over. But if you've hit like... If you're on like the 60th move of your combo, doesn't fucking matter where they are, you will just do a triple backflip through the air and find a way to get your fist in their face. And so like the longer it goes on, technically it's kind of getting easier, but also it's getting way more spectacular, and there's this like, your vision kind of blurs so that you're in focus and everything else kind of goes distorted and like the field of view gets played with and you're in like a sort of hallucinogenic trance where you're just flipping around everywhere, just hitting everybody all the time.
Yeah, still does that. That's still really fun. I enjoyed the game in spite of its complete lack of imagination and like the way it failed to build on any of what the Arkham games did. It's still really fun to punch.
I heard somebody saying that the writing is much better than the previous games.
Don't know about that. Paul Dini wrote the last one, I think, and he wrote the Batman animated series, which is fantastic. I really, really rate that as a good superhero series.
People criticised the last one for the enemy barks, which were really... misogynistic and unpleasant.
Really?
Like, whenever you played as Catwoman.
Yeah.
They were bad guys, I suppose.
Yeah.
You did them break their legs.
That was quite unpleasant. Yeah, though, in a game which relentless. Was otherwise quite silly in terms of its depiction of psychopaths.
They've really had to dig into the Batman lore to find villains for Batman Arkham Origins. So you get the gloves off a guy called the Electrocutioner. And his superpower is that he has electric gloves. That's it. That's one called Firefly, who flies around and has a flamethrower. Then there's Bane, who kind of, you know, he's the grit.
Still all of them.
And you do the same boss fight you did with him in the first game.
Really? That was the worst boss fight ever.
Yeah, so he charges at you and you dodge out of the way and then you snap something off his back to reduce his venom.
Is the Joker in it?
Yes, really... it's Batman game.
It's Troy Baker. Mandos.
Yeah, he's very good.
A guy from Bioshock Infinite and...
Yeah.
And really Last of Us.
Yeah, he's really good at
it. So you didn't get Mark Hamill back?
No, he's done with it to the Joker, I think.
Yeah, imagine it does something bad to his vocal cords.
It doesn't surprise me, raspy. You kind of shriek, don't you, to get it right. Cutscenes are spectacular. Again, it's one of those games where all the best things you do are in cutscenes. Batman is being best Batman when you're just kind of watching him do it rather than actually being it. It's a perennial problem with action games, generally.
Can I tell you about a cutscene from Splinter Cell Blacklist, which very much annoyed me.
Absolutely.
It's one of these cutscenes where, basically, I mean, you don't really have, any agency you have is whipped away from you during any cutscene, but it's particularly annoying when the cutscene makes you fail. And at the very climax of the game, this isn't, I suppose it's kind of a spoiler, but it's not a spoiler because nothing materially is affected by it. But you've just decimated this terrorist's entire army across the 10 hours of the game. Like, you've killed everybody. He's down to like 6 men in a bunker. And, after you've kind of got to this point where you're poised just to go in and fuck shit up, it cuts to a cutscene in which one of your colleagues goes in and surrenders to him. And you're like, what? why have you done that? It must be part of some cunning plan. But it isn't. He's just fucked everything up for no good reason. And you're like, why were you even here? Like, I could have just gone in there and broken all of their necks in like a couple of seconds. Baffling game.
And then doesn't it get resolved as well?
Yeah, and then just at the end of the cutscene, it's like, oh, no, never mind. Don't worry about that. Yeah. I don't know, I can't be bothered to say any more about Blacklist because Chris has already, totally, boned it. in previous podcasts. But yeah, disappointing and perverse and peculiar game it is indeed. And it sounds like Batman Origins is also kind of a bit of a wet blanket.
It's a wet blanket, yeah. I mean, it's kind of, if you liked the combat system and sneaking around and hunting people in the first 2 games, and that stuff was pretty good, then they've almost not broken it. so enjoy it.
Box quote.
Enjoy it based on that piece of advice. It's
almost not broken it.
This
is why, like, don't work on a sequel in a big AAA studio where it's being driven by the urge to release a game every year, because that's what your highest accolade will be. You almost didn't break it. Well done. I haven't played it yet, but speaking of this very similar thing, Assassin's Creed 4 sounds like it's actually good. And it's not out on PC till fucking end of November for some stupid reason, and it's out now on the other platforms.
I feel like I've played it already, given the number of trailers that have been pumped into the media.
I haven't counted them, but for Mass Effect 2, there were 35 trailers.
Wow.
Literally 35 trailers.
I think there's probably more minutes of Assassin's Creed 4 footage than I have actually lived.
But I was wondering, when you're talking about Splinter Cell, like, Ubisoft have a lot of franchises that they churn out new entries in, and Assassin's Creed is one of them, and...
They learned their lesson last time, though, didn't they? Because Assassin's Creed 3 really didn't do very well.
Didn't it? Ah, that's interesting. I knew it, like, it got bad reviews. Well, a lot of people I trust didn't like it. I think it got some very good reviews as well. But yeah, it sounded awful. but what's interesting about what I've seen of Assassin's Creed 4, I've just watched Kirk Hamilton from Kotaku did a good video where he just plays a side mission. Like, I think he's already completed the game. He's played it for, like, 40 hours or something. And then he's playing a mission he's never played before. And you can just, like, sail your ship to an island and then get off on the island. And then on the island, there's a warehouse with some supplies. And then your job is to find who's got the key to that warehouse, kill them, take the key, and then open the warehouse. And then you get a bunch of, like, resources for the metagame, whatever that is. But that island is like a Far Cry 3 outpost. And it's just a bunch of guards patrolling, and there's alarms, which are just big bells. And if you can get to the alarm before anyone sets it off, you can sabotage it by cutting the little ringer thing from the bell, which is awesome.
Oh, cool.
And it's just like a sort of totally open-ended, like, stealth outpost takeover. And it looks really fun to play.
Well, that solves one of my major bugbears with the Assassin's Creed series, which has always been that the actual act of assassination has been really boring and linear. If only they were to give it some kind of free-form aspect.
So you do things like, along the way, there are people who, like, I guess this is like a slave plantation, I think, and some of the slaves are being held at gunpoint, I guess, because they've, I don't know, tried to rebel or something. So you can kill the dudes holding the gunpoint, and then they become recruits, like sailors on your ship. So you expand your crew by doing that. It just looks really cool. But I was wondering if that was actually, like, if someone from Far Cry 3 actually came over and said, hey, look, guys, I'm going to show you how to do option objectives, because we did them really fucking well.
A bit I played of Assassin's Creed 4 at Gamescom was like an underwater bit. You can pilot your ship out into the middle of the sea and then drop a giant metal bell to trap, to create an air pocket, and then swim down there and keep getting air from that and explore.
A diving bell.
Diving bell, and as it's called. And then explore, like, shipwrecks underwater.
Awesome.
Which have chests in them for gold and stuff, and always sharks. And obviously, the sharks have exactly the same like stealth notifications as people do in that game. So there's like yellow alerts.
I think I see them.
So there's kind of a shark stealth ticker going on where they kind of they kind of see you and they
little
yellow.
Question mark goes boink off their heads.
the little bring.
Yeah. I'm seeing him, but I haven't seen him for very long. So yeah, I'm going to give up.
Exactly that logic. Which is exactly how sharks operate. but that bit was kind of boring, actually. And it was,
you can smell its fear, but I haven't smelled it for very long. So.
It's kind of a massive feature bloat in a lot of Ubisoft games where there's just nonsense collectibles that are designed to make the game longer, but more boring at the same time, but to make it feel more kind of worth, I don't know, $40.
Yeah, £40 another bullet point for the back of the box.
Yeah, precisely, put it on the cover. But I don't want to go around picking flowers to make potions in a game where I'm a fucking pirate.
It always feels like those games have just poured things on top rather than actually fixing anything that was fundamentally kind of askew with the original kind of game. It's always been, I mean, like, obviously when the first game came out, those traversal mechanics were mind-blowingly new and felt pretty awesome. But then, over the subsequent years, they have shown themselves to be somewhat lacking. Running across rooftops and, you know, Ezio decides to leap off into a canal.
Can't swim as well, Ezio.
I can't remember.
I don't think Ezio could swim. They fixed that. That's what they changed. Instead of sinking like someone made of titanium, you can actually swim around Venice.
But what I want from Assassin's Creed 4 is for that stuff just to be, for it to perfectly now match my intention when I'm running.
Yes.
And for the assassinations, to really sell the fact that you're an assassin. Because in the previous games, it was always kind of sneaking around the prescribed route, and then you shiv somebody in a cutscene, and then you just kind of fumble your way out, throwing smoke bombs hither and thither, and then just hide in some hay for a while.
They've still got their weird metafiction thing with the Abstergo Industries.
Seriously? Oh, really? I thought Desmond's
gone.
Oh, thank God.
Forever.
Who have you got instead?
It's a first-person mode this time, and apparently you wander around Abstergo, which kind of people who create the Animus, which lets you... I don't give a shit about that, or any of this stuff.
We find out more about the Animus.
Yeah, exactly. But you work there, and you sit down at a console, and your job is to trawl through memories. You don't have to be genetically related to the person you're with.
It's just like the cubicle version.
It's exactly right. So it's like an open plan office, and everyone's tapping into the kind of old assassin.
Yeah, just do what you like. I think you can play as this cool pirate guy in that one.
I think it's the games journalism of the future, really. You just plug in and get sucked into a different world. But apparently, visibly it's based on, like, the Ubisoft, Montreal office or something. It's really weird.
Oh, really?
It looks like the game dev's studio. I don't know, I haven't played it.
And what people do there is sit down and transport themselves to a virtual world where they're a pirate.
They get to be a pirate and stab
lots of stacked pizza boxes around the offices of Abstergo.
Absolutely. People working 20-hour shifts.
Yes.
Crying.
Crunchies.
Talking of annual franchises.
Yay! That's the segue I was looking for.
What have you been playing, Graham?
I've been playing Football Manager 2014. Right. Everyone looks for an exit. which is the latest version of the Football Manager game. It's very self-descriptive. And it's great. And I basically just wanted to talk a little bit about I've been playing Football Manager games for years and years. I used to play them as a kid, back when it was Championship Manager. And then I drifted away from it around 2004 or something like that. In part because it became far more complex, and playing through a single season of that game took longer and longer because the number of decisions you were making became more and more greater and greater. And as that happened, it became harder to see which pieces of information the game was giving you. were important and which weren't, and that made it hard to feel satisfied when you made a tactical decision and that changed the outcome of the matches that you were playing. You actually started to win leagues, or you suddenly lost the game. You were never quite sure, or I was never quite sure why that was. But with last year's update, they introduced Classic Mode, which is basically they realized that there were a whole bunch of people at the studio that weren't playing Football Manager anymore, and so they had like a team meeting where they said, why don't you play Football Manager anymore? Confronted them, like an intervention. And people said, we're sorry, we just don't have time, we have lives now, we're grown-ups, we've got kids, we don't have time to do these seasons which last 30 hours. So they made Classic Mode, where a single season can be played through in a mere 10 hours, which is still quite a substantial amount of time, but it just pulls back a lot of the feature creep that's come in over the last 10 years or so. And playing this version of it, there's a few other things I'm realizing. One is that in most games, when they have a kind of dedication to world building, like just creating this huge complex simulation, whether it's like Dwarf Fortress or a 4X game or Aurora, which we talked about, and I still haven't really played, I kind of admire that commitment to building such a complex system, and it's really compelling to play a character that charts a path through those decisions, and you don't need to understand the full system in order to get a lot out of just playing that game. Even if you, often they're roguelikes or they're 4X games where even if you fail, that's just kind of part of the story. Whereas I think because of the competitive nature of football, I feel compelled to win more. Like, it feels less like it's about telling an interesting story and more like this is about maximizing my strategy and working out the stats and playing this game to the best of my ability. In which case, it's just frustrating that there's all this information in there that isn't necessarily solely relevant to the strategies that I'm making. And the other thing that happens is that because I don't have a full grasp of what impact my decisions are having, that this is a game that made me, as a kid, superstitious. And I'm not superstitious at all, and I've never been superstitious about anything, but I would become superstitious about Championship Manager.
What do you mean, like, the kind of punditry that they do at actual football matches, where they say, oh, it was raining and it was away game at this stadium, the last time we won, we've got to recreate that scenario for us to win again, that kind of thing.
Or, I mean, like, actual, like, mentalness.
Oh, okay.
Like, I'm fairly obsessive compulsive anyway, but right. Like, convince myself as a little kid that, yeah, I knew it was bunk even then, but I would pump my fist with victory if I scored a goal, because if I didn't, I felt like the opposing team would score against me. And I knew that was rubbish, but I still got into the mindset of doing these things.
Right.
And there's a thing of, like, I find it somewhat unsatisfying, and I don't admire the world building in this game as much as I would do in other things. But it's like, there's something almost unethical about this type of game design, where you are encouraging people to try to succeed in a system that they can't control and can't fully understand. Like, if this game had microtransactional gambling in it, then it would bankrupt people. And there's a book that someone's written called Football Manager Ruined My Life, and it's kind of played for laughs, and it's quite a funny book about this guy's obsession with the game, and he does a stage show with it now, where like a one-man show at Edinburgh Fringe and stuff like that, and it's, you know, it gets really good reviews. But the obsession that this game encourages, I don't think is because people really like football. I think it's because it's a mental trap that you're getting sucked into this system where you're constantly striving for a sense of control that it can never possibly give you.
Yeah. I noticed that now that I've got more into trying to get to hell in Spelunky, like, a lot of the ingredients for doing that are just luck. It's just, I mean, for sure there are people who get to hell much more often than I do, and they're better at making the most of their luck. But you start to realize, like, if it just doesn't give you enough bombs, you just can't do it. It's just not going to happen. It's really down to just what the randomization gives you.
You're kind of trained by games to think that, you know, they're not random. They have a kind of fixed cause and effect that makes sense. And even if they have a vast set of numbers, that there is some optimal strategy that you can work out. And they functionally can't be purely random, because at the end of the day, there's an algorithm somewhere which is determining that stuff. So, you know, you you strive towards that level of understanding, and it's just impossible.
This is why real football managers get fired all the fucking time. They don't actually have control that they need to fire players, and maybe they're just like pushing levers at random. Just kind of hoping for the best, hoping that they'll score more goals.
They're just like mad numerologists, like trying to work out chaos yeah. theory, like the algorithm for describing the universe. I don't know,
I think in XCOM, I can't remember if this is a feature of Enemy Within or whether it's something they've patched in, but you can now, or will be able to, tell the game whether you want random chances to be determined ahead of time by a seed. Because it's a really controversial thing with, I think, this and some other Firaxis games where randomized stuff happens, is determined by a seed. And so if you do something that involves a dice roll, such as shooting someone in XCOM, and it doesn't work out, and then you reload your previous save game, if it's determined by a seed, then it will fail again. That shot will always fail. Even though it has a 90% chance to hit, it happens that you're in the world where that particular dice roll is always going to end up in the 10%. And they're giving you an option now to say, I want... I think actually the default one is that it re-rolls it every time. So you can reload, and I think it's called save spamming, or save scamming maybe, where you just reload the save game and take the chance again until it goes your way. And obviously, if...
Oh, I see. Right.
If you can't trust yourself not to do that, then you, like, it becomes an actual feature of the game that they just make the world deterministic in such a way that if that chance failed for you this time, it'll always fail for you. And I had to solve this in Gunpoint because I wanted, at one point I was trying to set up like a replay system and I never really got it working, but, if I was going to do that, any random chance, such as someone shooting at you, would have to be deterministic because I can't have it play out differently when you watch the replay, right? If you, for example, if you died in the game and then you don't die in the replay, I don't know what Conway should do at that point. But then, because Gunpoint is all about like loading a save game from 5 seconds ago and trying the exact same thing again, you can in Gunpoint currently save scam, or save spam, save jerk, and repeatedly reload, you know, until you get past the guy. You could like jump at an enemy who's facing you, and every time he shoots, there's some chance he'll miss. And so you could just keep on reloading that save game again and again and again until he misses.
That seems like an inefficient way of solving that problem rather than just doing something.
Yeah, my feeling was if someone actually wants to try that, then I won't stop them because I think they probably know if they don't have a fun experience, they probably know who's to blame for that. Right? I think deep down they can probably tell, you shouldn't have done that. But, I did wonder, like, if you did make it deterministic and say you're falling past a window and a guy shoots at you, and he hits you, and like usually if you're moving very fast vertically, it's hard for a guard to hit you because that's how, where they have to track you. You know, they have to be a good shot, track a moving target, it's going past their field of vision very quickly. So if you did that and then you got shot, and it was deterministic, if you reloaded the save game and did nothing differently, you would get shot again. But then if you reloaded the save game and did it slightly differently, like you did a little jump before you fell, so you're falling a bit faster, then should the dice roll be completely different? Should I totally change it so that it's a different dice roll? Or should it be the same dice roll, but the figure it's checking it against is now slightly more favourable? So if it was a 1% before, then you'll still get shot. But if it was like a 12% before, and now you've got a 98% chance of surviving, should you then survive? It's a area of mathematics that you only get into in video games, because in real life, you never get to take the same chance twice.
The thing with Football Manager is that despite being frustrated with the type of strategy game it is and not having full understanding, and you can do like the save jerk thing, and if you play the exact same game again and field the same team and your opponent fields the same team, it won't work out the same way. A player that did well the last time will just have a bad day. They just have like, there's some stat in there for, I'm going to have a shit day today. And that completely changed the result. But despite all my frustrations with it and the madness it inspires in me, I still keep clicking the button. Still keep pressing the button inside the Skinner box in order to get the pellets to come out, because it's
good pellets.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's a good game or not, or if it's just addictive in a really damaging way.
it's really popular. A game that's about a sport that is just British, basically. Like, you know, it's not called Soccer Manager. It's, you know, one of the most played games on Steam all the time, and that's incredible. Like, because I think they're all in the UK. I don't think it's played by American store. Like, it's just the UK, so it's probably almost all of the UK playing.
Shall we do questions from questions?
I think we should. Max Ursa says, "Hello, Crate and Crowbarometers of Gaming? Podcast inflection?" He says in brackets. I hope I did it justice. "As Star Citizen steamrolls through crowdfunding with 23.4 million and 280,448 individual registered citizens..."
It's now up to 25 million.
"Well, are any of you invested in it personally, or at least watching closely?" I don't know if invested but he means it emotionally, or whether we've actually invested in it with money. "Personally, I have the Pathfinder package with the 315p exploration variant of the 300i. The ship from the What Is Speed advert slash trailer. My aims are to explore space, find new jump routes, salvage derelict vessels of unknown origins, and name a previously undiscovered star system. There are about 5 studios stateside working together to produce Star Citizen, plus the newly formed Foundry 42 here in Manchester, headed by Aaron Roberts to handle production of the Squadron 42 campaign. There doesn't seem to be much coverage in the gaming press, and what is covered is mostly the growing supply of Wonga. This in turn seems to garner scorn and doubt towards the game from the general public. Do you, as the press, receive much information on the progress of the game development? I apologise for my extra disjointed writing and blame it on the codeine. Keep up the good work, chaps. Max Ursa."
I think it is kind of eclipsed from the general gaming media. I think it's probably because these kind of Kickstarter campaigns talk directly to their communities and they don't really need a second party to pass.
Games press is redundant, you say.
Well, I think it kind of is. That's why, I mean, look at the massive success of Dota. I mean, it took a long time for the gaming press to even get on board with the success of that, or World of Tanks or League of Legends. They were basically never mentioned in the press. And I think the same is true of these Kickstarter phenomenons. I'm not personally invested in it.
I think it's weird that thing has made a fuck of a lot of money.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, do you remember, it wasn't that long ago, but making $3 million on Kickstarter was the biggest deal in the world, and no one could stop talking about Double Fine's adventure thing. This thing made $25 million, and it hasn't been that long since the other one.
Yeah, it makes a million a week. Like they made an announcement saying, "Hey, we hit $23 million," and then 2 weeks later, right, "Well, we just hit $25 million, so...
Jesus Christ. That news story about how much money we had caused us to make loads of more money.
The reason I knew it was $25 million was because I wrote a story about it, because I'm in the games press, and the story I wrote was it hit $25 million. So he's completely right about the Wonga thing. But I was looking at their website, and they do a really good job, actually, in communicating with their audience in terms of what the current state of development is. They do regular updates. Chris Roberts does regular posts as, like, letters from the chairman of Robert Space Industries, and he does video blogs. And they've also got a really clear kind of development roadmap for features that they want to add in future and what they're working on. And any time they hit like a funding goal, like $25 million, they immediately say, "Oh, if we hit $27 million, here's the next stretch goal," that kind of thing. And so they do a really good job.
Got new shit to build.
Is there any evidence of like actual progress in the development of the game? I don't mean to sound cynical. But I'm just like, I've seen lots of trailers, which presumably use in-game assets, but they're otherwise CGI kind of fully rendered things, and that's not indicative of a functioning game, obviously. But I wonder what there is.
I don't know if they did they put out like a really simple alpha or like a ship hangar or something.
Walk around ship,
there was a hangar thing.
And then people have kind of found ways to jerry-rig that so you can actually fly the ships around. So there's videos on YouTube of, like, and things you're not supposed to be able to do, I think, but actually first-person animations for your character climbing inside a ship, getting inside the chair of the cockpit, taking off, flying around and stuff.
Isn't the thing that you can buy access to a particular vehicle, because there are different tiers, so you buy access to a particular vehicle, but actually if you just hack it, they're all unlockable.
That's what Max is talking about when he says he bought the Pathfinder package with the 315p, I guess that's a ship, variant of the 300i, which must be a ship class. I really like that Max has like an idea of what he wants to do in the game. He says, "My aims are to explore space, find new jump routes, salvage derelict vessels of unknown origins, and name a previously undiscovered star system."
That sounds cool.
It does. I mean, that's the promise, isn't it? But I mean, the reason I'm not invested is because that promise hasn't coalesced into anything material yet. And until it does, I'm really reticent to put my money towards it.
I'm extremely skeptical about it as well.
It's such an ambitious game.
But look at all the money! Surely money just directly translates to quantum.
Like, I think Chris Roberts seems to have his head screwed on fairly tight. I don't think he's a flight of fancy arty guy who's going to piss all this money away, like maybe some other Kickstarter projects. But but you know, not all of the Wing Commander games were gold, and he hasn't done that much in that long, and just that it's such an ambitious project, it reminds me of the original PlanetSide, which wasn't just the huge scale first-person shooter that PlanetSide 2 eventually became, but also was supposed to have player-built cities and a player-driven economy, and was going to do all this EVE Online stuff in terms of players putting hit orders on other people, and you would form a crew and you would hang out in your apartment, and then you would, you know, like, and all this stuff just got cut back and cut back and cut back because really hard to do. To be, to let your players discover an uncharted galaxy and then name it.
And there's a kind of really interesting, kind of irreducible problems with making space games that I think the next question addresses.
Is also about space games. Eskil Steenberg, creator of Love. Maker of Love, you could say. The game Love. Says, Dear Crate and Crow Barbarellas. Good one.
Yeah.
I love space. I want to look forward to Star Citizen, Elite Dangerous, and the prospect of more homeworld, but I have some doubts. Games are fundamentally about overcoming obstacles, and space is the very definition of a lack of obstacles. Without terrain and cover, the tactics of space games get reduced to turning towards your enemy and clicking on them. While features like vast procedural universe and seamlessly get in your ship and take off sounds great, no game has yet given me a hint that they have solved the main problem of space games, how to make an interesting game out of a vacuum. How would the CNC generals suggest we fix space combat games so that they are as fun in reality as they are in our imaginations?
Well, the thing there is that dogfight combat thing, which he's saying is kind of simplistic. I wouldn't necessarily solve that, but I think I would, like Star Citizen promises to, make it a smaller part of the game, like the overall game. I think Star Citizen does have things like, I mean, it does introduce asteroid fields and things like that. I mean, judging by the CGI trailers, but I think the majority of the game is that sense of exploration and trade and your position within like some kind of galactic society. That's the thing that's attractive.
I think that FTL hit on something.
It's about your ship.
Is the fragility of your ship, absolutely. And the like space games, basically like World War II dogfighting games, really, but in a vacuum. I'd like space games to actually having a crack on a glass window in a vacuum is fucking serious. You know, if that goes wrong, you depressurize the cabin and get flung into space. I mean, I'd want that kind of sense of danger from piloting the spacecraft. The slightest nick causes oxygen to start draining out of your cockpit, and you have to fix that, and that's actually the obstacle.
Actually, now that we're talking about this, the movie Gravity is basically the movie of FTL. Shit, a bunch of random shit hit our ship, and now it's on fire in several different places, and now we're losing oxygen, and now we have to do this.
They're kind of doing that in the middle of a fight as well, and it's kind of...
Well, I mean, they've sold it. I mean, they've sold it, the idea of that sense of embodiment, being able to get in and out of a ship seamlessly. If you are in some way embodied and kind of autonomous from your ship, and there are things that you can do to interact with your ship.
Yeah, that'd be great.
That's interesting. I mean, one of the things that makes Star Wars still quite an alluring fantasy for games is the idea that you jump to a different set of turrets, and you know, you're like, you know, Chewie going man of whatever's. I'm sure that's a dialogue line.
Like, Chewie going man of whatever's.
It's probably better than most of the lines George Lucas did actually write. So.
Lovers in a Dangerous Spacetime is a game about this, where you are two characters in a platformer, but the platformer is a spaceship, and you have to run to, like, man the north turrets to shoot these enemies down because they're coming in from the north. And it's really cool. But yeah, I think, like, the interesting thing about space, I think CCP once said something to the effect of the reason they were letting you be a person and walk around was that girls don't want to be a spaceship. And, at the time I thought, oh, that's a shame because I want to be a spaceship. But then, maybe our love can never work. But then I thought, no, I actually don't want to be a spaceship.
No,
I don't want to be a spaceship. I want to be a dude in a spaceship.
Yeah.
Or a girl in a spaceship. And I want to, like, the interesting thing about space is me being inside an object that is itself traveling past other objects. Mm. And I want to be, like, you know, putting out the fires and making sure there's oxygen and running around that little vessel. And the fact that that's also moving through this incredible, like, open, empty space with other people moving through it with their own problems and on their own trajectories is really interesting.
I love the kind of abstraction from that cockpit dogfighting combat stuff that you get in, say, the sci-fi novels of Ian Banks, where you you know, the ships are fighting, but it's the ships fighting, not really you. It's like all these AI procedures, these little buzzing kind of nanobots doing their own kind of counter maneuvers and things like that.
And Eve is a bit like that. You just sort of tell it, I want to shoot this guy with this weapon. Take care of it, please.
Maybe that's a bit too abstracted. Like, I think this seems, I mean, for the kind of, that obviously satisfies a large number of people, but for the kind of mass audience who likes some kind of action level of interaction, having a ship that you need to run around or do stuff with, I think you could find a compromise between the two, basically. Yeah.
See, I would like the kind of the space combat game to be built on top of something like Kerbal Space Program, which completely sells the idea of space not as just being this big empty void or vacuum in the way that Eskil worries about it, but in terms of just being this slidey soup that's really hard to traverse because you're constantly moving. There's no way. It's extremely difficult to get your ship to be still. It's extremely difficult
to
turn your ship.
What stationary is.
Yeah. It's extremely difficult to get your ship to turn around because you've got this kind of mass and heft to you that you're using these very small engines to blast air to make very slight adjustments. And so if you've got a thing of like trying to dock two ships together in space and they're both on different orbital paths, the kind of arithmetic involved in your own head, and Kerbal Space Program has a nice interface for kind of plotting the maneuvers of how you move your ship in order to align them and hook them up to build like a space station in space. But if you were doing that but with pellets or whatever, like I want the game where I'm firing cutlery out of the cannons around a planet to skewer my opponent on the other side using the gravitational pull of the moon we're both
I wanted to make around. Like an iPad game about this that would be called something like Trajectory, and you are, it is a combat game, you're trying to kill other people, but they're like, if anything hits you, you're dead, because if anything punctures your hull, it will completely destroy your ship. And so it's all about just, can you actually fire something at the other person and have it hit them, whilst calculating how gravity is going to pull those projectiles, and also how firing a projectile will affect your own trajectory, because it will always be, by outputting that mass, you're going to be offset by that amount. And if there's a projectile coming towards you, you've got to figure out, do I have time to fire a projectile at it and knock it out of the way? And if I do, am I going to, like, knock myself into this sun? Am I going to go into, like, a downward spiral and be crashing into this planet or something?
There's, like, an essay by a physicist about how space combat should actually
work. Is it Robin Sloan?
I don't remember the name of it, but I'm sure we could Google it.
Didn't Robin Sloan do this?
Be actually, but I know the article you're talking about, and that's exactly what I was thinking of. I'm not sure if it's Robin Sloan or not that wrote it.
Robin Sloan is an author who's written some really cool semi-sci-fi stuff.
He's a journalist who writes a website called Snark Market, and then, wrote Annabelle Scheme.
Yeah, which is awesome.
Which is brilliant, which he did as a Kickstarter project, actually, very early on in Kickstarter, and it's about a lady detective and her AI sidekick solving crimes
like
in a world where
sort of like
quantum
blade.
Computing exists.
Yeah, she has like a blade server as her sidekick. So it's just like a computer.
Yeah, really good essay. You should read it. It makes it sound like space combat is, if we ever find ourselves in a position of having to fight people extraterrestrially, then it will be basically a tower defense game. the lines of attack are essentially dictated by how you slingshot around other gravitational bodies. And
it's got to be a good game in it.
Oh yeah.
Particularly the Oculus Rift, where you can kind of like, you can look around very easily, and also like the position of your head can be another degree of freedom you have. You have a mouse and the Oculus Rift, you have two different ways of looking in all directions.
EVR does that so well, because it's the only... I played quite a lot of Oculus Rift games, but EVR was the first I played where looking around is actually part of the mechanics.
Yeah,
so you've got
look at something to lock on, right?
Yeah, so you've got your lasers which just fire ahead of you in that kind of standard dogfighting way, but then you look at a ship in order to get a lock on to it by holding down the right trigger when you're looking at it, and then you release your missiles by letting go. And that's just a super satisfying mechanic,
really cool.
That idea of looking out the top windows of your spaceship to see the thing that's arcing around you is much more fun than I've played X-Wing versus TIE Fighter and those kinds of games, and I did find them slightly frustrating for the thing Esco says of just kind of turning your ship around to click on the thing.
Fictonox asks, "Dear Crate and Crow Bros." I don't think we've had that one before.
No.
It's good. "Why do bad games exist?" Ideally, the developers do a lot of playtesting and can tell if the game is fun, balanced, and bug-free before it's released. What are the common things that can go wrong during this process? Thank you for the Harrison Insightful podcast.
I think the answer is that they really can't tell. Otherwise,
well, I wanted to answer this because this will sound bad, but if you want to know why bad games exist, you should read Chris Plant's write-up on Polygon of the development of XCOM The Bureau, or whatever it's called, The Bureau Declassified, XCOM The Bureau. because although that game, I think, turned out apparently pretty well, I haven't played it yet, but got sort of okay reviews. If you just want to understand, like, all the different forces pulling on a given development team in every possible direction, it's just a fucking nightmare. Like, the more insight you get into how big budget games are made, the more stunned I am that any of them are any good at all. Because, like, the people making the decisions are not the designers, and they are working on data about how games sell that is so incomplete and so misleading and so flawed, and they have so much power over the people who actually make the kind of, who, like, usually the lead designer on a game, or perhaps the creative director, is the person who's trying to make it good, and their range director, let's make this game good so that it's fun and we enjoy playing it, or whatever their objective is. And then there's somebody else who's responsible for, let's make it profitable and make sure it sells, and in order to make it profitable, we need this feature, we need that feature, and we need this, and you've got to have boss fights, and you've got to have, you know, if you're making Assassin's Creed, what was it? What was the one before 3? Like 7? The one where they added like a tower defense game? Like, there was obviously some dictate from above to say, we need a new feature we can put on the back of the box and tell people there's a new thing you can do in this game, even though that has nothing to do with assassination, and we haven't remotely come close to actually making the game we wanted to make in the first place about assassinating people. Like, we haven't made it good yet. We're going to keep on just adding new features instead of trying to improve the main core thing. And then, of course, like, there's deadlines, and there's really tight budgets, and everyone is being paid a salary, and those salaries are... you know, even just a moderate salary for the number of people involved in making these games means you're just bleeding money at $1 million every couple of months. And it's just like, you're in emergency panic death mode at all times. And it's just incredible that anyone makes anything good. Particularly stuff like Far Cry 3. I think Far Cry 3 is like, I think a single player campaign in that is rubbish, the story. But it's also a fantastic open world game, and it has a co-op campaign, and it has deathmatch multiplayer that's good as well, and like, so 3 of the 4 different games they made are really good. One of them is shit, but even the one that's shit was really expensive and difficult to make, and, you know, must have taken a lot of their budget, and I don't think it's shit for budget reasons or anything. I think it's shit because they tried to make something that, you know, they just have a different philosophy for how you should make games to what I enjoy. But how the hell did that get made? How did you make a game that has, like, this really, like, huge open world and this, like, fantastic stealth systems, and really, like, just taking over outposts in that game is more hours of fun than you'll get from almost any other game released that year.
And those studios are, like, not including outsourcing, like, 600 man strong.
I think they said just 800 on Assassin's Creed 3.
Oh, okay.
Which is just, like, fucking insane.
So, I mean, like, you know, having worked on magazines of maybe 10 people, that's really difficult to manage.
Yep. That's hard work.
So, yeah, 800 people, just the bureaucracy of that is an incredible obstacle.
You mentioned that Splinter Cell Blacklist cutscene.
Oh, yeah.
Earlier, and how it didn't really make sense. And
it's probably because it's like some hived off fragment of some previous design that they'd abandoned.
Yeah, it was probably meant to appear in a different level in a different context, and it was probably meant to be the lead in to a whole other section of the game in a different city, which they built half of, and then got cut because, you know, it wasn't testing well. And it's just,
I think big budget games, you spend a lot of money before it's even in a playable state, and before you even realise that it's not fun, and then that's when everyone shits themselves. They realise, and that they like, just cancelling it, that happens a lot, but sometimes it just isn't an option if you've already paid so much money and it's a big kind of studio gamble. So they have to kind of plod on, try and fix it, and budget constraints means they just can't.
And XCOM The Bureau thing, there's so much stuff in there about, like, there's, you know, 15 different games that they tried to make, and they're all really different, and they all have different ideas, and then they're all, like, some of them are really brave, some of them are kind of stupid, some of them are interesting, some of them boring, and at every stage there's always, like, you know, will the publishers go for it? Will they fund it? Will they think it's worth putting money into it? And their estimation of what's going to make money is really just random.
they were speaking to the Thief developers, and they were going through, or have been going through, a similar sort of thing. And like, they announced Thief 4, Thief 4, as it was called, like 4 or 5 years ago. And they did that in order to recruit a team, because they wanted a bunch of people to come move to Montreal to work there. And so they said, hey, we're making Thief. You're like Thief. Come work for us.
That was still, did.
the game didn't exist at that point. And then they spent like 6 months to a year just like working on pre-concept stuff of like, what is a Thief game in this age? And then they worked it out and they made a vertical slice of it, which was third person. And they made like a big chunk of the game. They spent 6 to 12 months working on that. And then they went, this isn't right. And they scrapped it completely. And now it's a first person game and they started again. And, I remember going as well to the Real Time Worlds when they were working on APB.
Oh God.
Which is like, and the game wasn't fun really when I played it, but it had lots of potential and they had lots of good ideas. But they said afterwards, after it came out and it was bad and it had collapsed, they said that Crackdown only got good about 3 months before it came out, and they'd been working on it for like 3 years, and so they just thought that they're working on APB for 3 years, so it's going to get good.
Still to come.
It's going to get good any minute now, and then they ran out of money, and we're like, oh, we didn't have time for that last 3 months.
That is hugely irresponsible, though.
It is.
You know, I think that kind of typifies, I think I've said this on a previous podcast, but it does typify a kind of attitude within at least British game development, where I think because it was such a grassroots industry, from that kind of backroom, bedroom coder kind of philosophy comes this idea of just this, you know, skunk works kind of throw stuff together and hope it shakes down. And, that doesn't really work. That doesn't scale to the kind of the AAA production line as it happens.
So that's why you get Ubisoft employing people who are just there to say, you've got to add a tower defense mode.
Yeah.
Like, you've got to make sure that this is profitable, because if you don't find a way to impose rigid structure on 800 man teams or 300 man teams, then they just, you know, float along and you're just crossing your fingers and maybe burning away hundreds of millions of pounds.
So, like, also with games, it's really hard to predict how long they're going to take, because most of the challenges you're solving are things that haven't been solved before, so you don't know how long it's going to take to solve them. And that's, you know, a famous thing, like everyone knows that games get delayed and no one really knows how long they're going to take. And, my game I thought would take a year or less, and it took 3 years. So I spent three times the amount of time I thought it would take, and then I also cut like 50% of what I had planned. So I rip out half of it, still take three times as long as I thought it would. And if I'd had a budget, if I'd had to pay myself, you know, a salary, if I'd had to pay a team of 100 people a salary, and I'd said it would take a year to make it, and then it took 3 years to make it, like, can't do that. You can't take three times as long as you thought you would. So you get to that 1 year mark and you just have to fucking release something, or you have to release something at a year and a half. So you have to like ask for extra money, and then the extra money comes with a bunch of like caveats and all of, you know, okay, we'll give you extra time, but you have to put in this feature and we have to compromise the design in this way in order to make it more commercial.
I personally missed the tower defense element of Gun.
I did have to scrap that, yeah.
This is why you got to hope that Gabe Newell is the founder of your company, because when he doesn't like the game that you're making in 1997, he can just say, I would just scrap it and start again and fund another year of development out of his pocket. And then did the same thing for Half-Life 2, funded like 2 years of development just out of his own personal pocket, and like a salary budget of, as you say, $1 million a month.
It's crazy. Hopefully that shed some light on why some games are bad. Hopefully it makes you confused that any games are any good. JL, I will credit him as he's written his name, ask, hello, patrons. Marsh at one point suggests Nuclear Throne take pointers from Spelunky on balancing, like the choice to go to either the City of Gold or Hell. Actually, you have to go to the City of Gold to get to Hell. Only the castle, the mothership, and the worm are branches, and they're all one-off cul-de-sacs. Serious players tend to ignore them because their rewards are generally more amusing than useful, and in any case, impossible to bring with you through the spoiler ritual into the high-scoring portions of the game. Which is referring to the fact that you can't take an object through the City of Gold, because you have to use an object to get to the City of Gold that you have to carry in your hands. It's actually one of the few chinks in Spelunky's overall design. You can theoretically do almost every unique event in the game in one run, and in particular, there is only a single questline affecting the ending and score. We can only imagine how it would be if there were multiple mutually exclusive endings, or, since content development kills roguelikes, multiple quest chains to choose between for Hell. The new Tunnelman mechanic is actually a neat example of quests and conducts, but of course it's tied to one of the unlocks rather than an intra-run progression. A door that requires the camera? A fast sub-boss that can only be stomped requiring the web gun to tie it down? Greater interaction with Carly? there are all sorts of handles there for Spelunky itself to learn from, among others, FTL, with its blue event system.
Can I think answer to this?
Should we quickly explain what the blue event system is in FTL?
Oh, yeah.
If I remember correctly, it's there's sometimes you'll have an interaction with like a certain race, like the rock people or something. Correct me if I'm getting this wrong. And it'll be a blue event, and that will mean, like, they'll ask you to do something, and it's telling you this will lead to further missions. And if you successfully complete that mission, then you successfully complete the next mission, and then you do this whole quest chain within the scope of FTL before you die, then you unlock the rock people's ship, and then you have that forever, and that's the thing you can play with from then on. So it's a really cool thing when you find those, like, when you get the first quest chain, like, oh my god, I can do the lizard people's event, or the invisible people's event, whatever the options are. So it's like a special, unique story thing that then, once you've done it, permanently unlocks something.
Can I just explain what I meant in the previous podcast? I mean, he's writing that, the branches that you find in Spelunky aren't mutually exclusive in absolute terms. I mean, he's totally right about that, but for me, they definitely are. Because on any given playthrough of Spelunky, I'm only basically deciding where I'm going to die. So if I am faced with a choice of, oh, do I want to go through the worm place, I'm likely to die in the worm place. So I'm just, yeah. So it is really a very significant branching and final choice for me as on a single playthrough. Maybe if I was as good as JL, then it wouldn't be a problem.
I think you're just saying, like, you couldn't decide to, I'm going to die in hell, but not the City of Gold, because you have to go through the City of Gold.
Yeah. But I mean, the thing in Nuclear Throne, I mean, there's none of those kind of decisions in Nuclear Throne. When obviously you get pickups and they change your tactics then going forward, but there's no kind of significant, I mean, for example, you don't, like in Spelunky, when you realise, oh, I can buy a jetpack on this level, that changes the way you approach that level entirely, because it means that you then spend the rest of the level getting as much gold as you can to go back and buy. And that not only, that changes your approach to the acquisition of that item, and the acquisition of that item also then changes the game fundamentally from then on, and the kinds of things that you're capable of doing. Whereas in Nuclear Throne, the decisions, although they are quite nuanced and interesting, they are more about just the kind of moment-to-moment action of the game. Like, am I going to use a melee weapon which can deflect bullets? Or am I going to, you know, pick up a grenade launcher and hope that I don't get into trouble in close quarters?
I think he's right about the kind of the scope for more choice in the
games. I think the benefit of all roguelikes, you know, I mean, the more kind of individual outcomes you have in a roguelike, the better, surely.
Yeah. I never thought about it in Spelunky, really, but it's true that you don't really have many choices. Like, I do. I think I'm going to focus on trying to get to this level, trying to get this object. But potentially, if you're good enough, you can do that and then go on to do your ultimate objective. Whereas if it had mutually exclusive things, if there was, like, there is kind of already, you can end the game the normal way and defeat the final boss, or you can go to hell and defeat a different boss. And you still defeat the normal boss as well, but then you've got this kind of, like, an extra objective. And so it's, I think the game, I've never completed it that way, but I think the game sort of implies that is the real ending, and that's what really completing the game means. But if there were just four different bosses, and one of them's at the end of the worm level, or one of them's at the end of the castle level, and one of them's at the end of the City of Gold, and one of them's at the end of the normal thing, that would be interesting. It would be like, which thing do you want to do?
Well, the thing is, you only have that perspective having either completed the game or having watched a lot of YouTube videos about people completing it. When I first started playing Spelunky, I had no idea really what the objective of the game was. And we started playing the daily challenges, I didn't even realise that the end goal was to make money. I thought it was just exploration, because that's what interests me about Spelunky.
Yeah, and that it should be.
So when I'm faced with a choice about do I go here or there, then I'm not thinking about, oh, this is going to be a means to the end game. I'm just thinking about where I want to see.
Yeah. Kane says, while listening to you Knights of the Bruised Table talk about Democracy 3 last episode, I wondered what you'd think of the argument that Democracy 3 really should have been Democracy 2 HD. Don't get me wrong, I'm usually the sort of person who turns the scorn beams up to maximum when somebody says a sequel is actually just a mod of or an expansion of the previous game. But that's because it's often said of sequels that tell a new story with the same solid mechanics. It's not like Democracy 3 is telling some new story, though. It's Democracy 2, with an admirably beautified UI, some balance changes, and a small number of new policies. All positive stuff, but if you've already played Democracy 2, you'd be mad to pay $25 for that. I found it saddening, because while Democracy 2 is excellent, it's easy to look at it and see how it could be improved with a bit more depth. For instance, instead of being a single scalar value, education could be a histogram showing the percentage of your voters who have poor, modest, adequate, good, excellent, or no education.
which would allow you to represent private schools better, because they give excellent educations, but only to a small portion of the population who can afford them. And model the fact that university grants only help if you have enough education to get into and succeed at university. And complex policies like the space program could be improved by making them much more powerful, and also having them constantly run into problems. Cost overruns, contractors flaking out or delivering poor results, shuttle disasters, which you have to deal with on their policy page, choosing solutions that cost political capital, money, and public opinion to get the program back on track. Or maybe you can save on political capital by letting your minister handle it, but asking a transport minister with motorist sympathies to handle cost overruns on a national monorail might be a bad idea. Jesus Christ, I've already thought about this. I guess I'm saying that Democracy 2 is one beautiful dimension, and when I heard about Democracy 3, I hoped it would be at a second dimension, but instead I got the same single dimension again with a fancier hat on. What do you think? Have there been other games whose sequels missed an opportunity to add depth to their predecessors' lacked? Or have there been games that did what Democracy 3 did, but did it well enough to deserve their full price? Thanks for reading, everybody!
I kind of agree with them that Democracy 3 is not a huge leap forward in terms of adding new ideas or really deepening the simulation from Democracy 2. I think it's not just a prettier UI. And first of all, like, the UI is amazing. Like, the UI is maybe my favourite UI in all of the games. Like, it's a game about that menu screen much more than it's about anything else. But they've rebalanced a lot of stuff in the game, which I think makes it more interesting in terms of where your decisions will lead you. Like, almost anything you did in Democracy 2, you would get assassinated really quickly. Like, and that's still a frequent outcome in Democracy 3, because I've been playing it quite a bit this past week, but at the very least, you get 4 or 5 terms before someone is eventually annoyed enough to try it.
Man, that's progress. I wish somebody would kill me in Democracy 3. Like, I mean, it would certainly benefit the citizens of Marshtopia. Man, that place is fucked up.
I suppose it's a weird game, because obviously there are tons of different ways in which you can deepen that simulation. Like, the fact that it has no, I think JL maybe as the second part of his question that we didn't read out, mentions that the fact that it doesn't have any concept of parliament. Like, you make your decisions and they get carried out, assuming you've got enough political capital, and the political capital is determined by
your party will never have its policy initiatives stymied for 8 years by a minority or of the US federal government dedicated to the destruction of the US federal government.
Yeah.
So, like, there's a very simple kind of influence mechanic in there in terms of your cabinet, and they're the thing that give you action points, and then you use those action points in order to use policies. But that's actually far less interesting than real politics, in which it's about what favours you can call in and working on with other congressmen, and then you add in campaign donations and what did you promise in order to get into power in the first place? What was your mandate and your manifesto? And then, like, who did you take money from to fund your campaign that you now need to pay back? Like, there's all these different things that you could simulate.
Did you ever get your wife to take on, you know, speeding fines for you?
Yeah. But I'm not sure that it necessarily needs to do any of that to be a good game. Yeah.
Entirely. I mean, I think Doctor 3 is a game about social engineering, about prodding. It's all social systems and watching their interactions. I'd love to play a game about politics. Maybe like a politician's roguelike where you're just trying to get elected and trying to call in favours, or are you going to ally with the unions, or are you going to go for that kind of, you know, you're going to go, it is about favours and promising people things.
Yeah, I mean, the ironic thing about Democracy 3 is that it's all about policies, and politics isn't really about that at all.
Fascinating to play again.
But it's like, even its simulation of social engineering is quite simple. Like, I was able to today create a utopia in about 4 years. made very simple decisions and wiped out all crime, all disease, created an environmental paradise.
Man, I don't know. Blood is running through the streets of Marshtopia.
It's just easy ways to game the system, basically, like, because of, it's quite simple and abstract in terms of the way it's doing the social engineering, but it's still really satisfying to just
poke this little slider and then click the next turn and go, oh, this thing over here, this thing is sprouted. Like, there is just that, there's a very simple cause and effect to it, which is why I say that it's a game almost more about that menu than it is anything else, because it's just about this giant menu of different buttons, and then when you mouse over those different buttons, it shows you how those all interact, and with like a flowchart of like, this is having a negative impact on this, and this is having a positive impact on that.
Yeah,
and
that's
it has these little dotted lanes that go between the things, and the
anything as so clearly mapped out.
Wow. The speed of those lanes is related to the strength.
God.
If it's moving fast, that means it's having a really strong impact.
That's
on
amazing.
That thing.
I'll show you after.
And
it's honestly beautiful.
Yeah. And so it's just this kind of, it's just playing with that and just going, ooh.
Yeah. I understand
it. I persuaded a friend of mine who works in the civil service to play it over the weekend, and he kind of emailed me back saying, well, you know, I've abolished religion and poverty and race hate and taxes. My citizens are pretty chuffed. I was like, yeah, you probably are in the right job. And then I look at my playthrough of it, I think, as an illustrator, I'm probably also in the right job.
And I should just wash it.
Definitely keep me far away from government.
Kane asks, have there been other games whose sequels missed an opportunity to add depth their predecessors lacked? And as he was talking about Democracy 3 versus Democracy 2, I was thinking about Civ 5 versus Civ 4, because I think I prefer the mechanics of Civ 4, but Civ 5's UI is so much more beautiful that I literally can't go back to Civ 4. Civ 4, I remember, like, when I played at the time, I thought, wow, what a beautiful user interface and how nice it is to use. And after Civ 5, just no. It's horrible. It's like, oh god, even the font is like, oh, what are you doing to me? It's just disgusting to look at. It's so much worse. And Civ 5 is like, it's, I don't think it's like the best presentation of Civ. I think there's probably a better way to present it, because the sort of pretty mode very much obfuscates where does that tile finish and what does that tile really have on it, and is that cloud part of that tile and is that mountain range part of that tile? And then you can switch to like a sort of basic sprite mode that's really clear about the mechanics, and it really makes it obvious, like, oh, there's some sheep in that tile and then this one is worth 5 gold and that kind of thing. But the general interface is really, really slick in Civ 5. But I'm also like, every time they do an expansion, they're always just like, let's add some systems to Civilization. I'm like, you've got enough systems! Just stop! And look at those systems, figure out if they're all really working in the best way they possibly could, because I think about 2 or 3 of them are really, really not. And one of those is moving your military units around, because it's a fucking pain in the ass, and it's really boring. No one enjoys it, and even the designers of Civilization 4 and Civilization 5 both agree that this is just a massive pain in the ass and doesn't actually add any tactical depth, and just, like, the end game, like, after someone has already made the biggest army, just every fucking turn you've got to move every fucking unit, because they won't, you can't end your turn until they've done something. And even if it's just tell
still.
Them.
Yeah, they ask you, do you want to keep standing still? Every turn. It's like, yes. Yeah. What do you do? Just shut up. Stay there. Just stay there.
Just shut up! I wonder if any real generals are... we need order, sir. Just shut up! Just leave me the fuck alone! I have to manage, like, tax and shit. I have to build every city in this whole empire myself. And, for some reason, micromanage you.
Indiscuss. The last thing I'd say about Democracy is that, although it is not a sequel, maybe in the way that we come to think about sequels, like, far more people have not yet bought Democracy that should. And it's great that they can now buy a version of that game, which is significantly improved. So if you've played Democracy 2, this is not essential. But it's great for the people who haven't. And
I know many more Democracy game before, and this is fucking mind-blowingly awesome.
Craig asks, hello chaps, I've recently finished playing through Dark Souls and am now replaying it on New Game Plus. Despite knowing how to defeat each boss, where to go at points, and killing most of the low-level enemies in a single swipe of my massive sword, I am finding a second playthrough vastly more enjoyable than my first. I put most of this down to how frequently I had to consult a walkthrough originally, due to being lost. Originally, I had this down to bad design. How could they possibly expect players to know where to go? I would often wonder to myself, after being set back to a bonfire for the umpteenth time. People will just get lost and confused. Eventually I concluded that this was supposed to be the case. Players are really supposed to feel depressed and lost in a world that doesn't care about them, and this is what Dark Souls is all about. So my question is this. Are there any aspects of games that you originally thought were poorly executed, but seem to make more sense later on? Also, I realise how much of a pansy I might sound saying that. I had to use a walkthrough. P.S. Fuck Capra Demon. So, Tom, you already answered this.
Yeah, it's the void.
With the void. Seems like a similar vibe to Dark Souls in some ways. Like, it wants you to feel bad.
It's supposed to make you feel shit. I mean, the thing about the void is that it kind of drains from you constantly. You can just screw yourself if you don't plant enough colour trees early on or if you tend to them poorly. And that won't, your death won't come until like hours later as a result. Mm. And you won't know that you've made a bad decision.
Yeah,
so it's just fucks you up. But it's kind of supposed to enrage and make you hate the game by the end.
Michael Gapper of Edge magazine has a theory that this is true of Kane and Lynch 2.
Yes, he loves that game.
Yeah, he really does, and I didn't really very much love it at all. But I think it does have a point to some extent, because it's intentionally like a really aesthetically ugly game. It's got this amazing kind of art style, which makes it look like it's all shot on a really low-rent, cheap knockoff video camera. And so it's kind of constantly, the vision is constantly artifacting. It's kind of like blown out, oversaturated, or even just kind of like just, you can't see anything because it's all white when you walk into a room with lights in it. And that kind of similar grottiness is true of the actual physicality of that game. I don't know how much that is intentional. Like, Mike Gapper insists that all the weapons are shitty and spammy and rubbish because that's somehow what the game makes you want to feel like it's meant to kind of construct firefights where people are just kind of wildly blamming into the air and never hitting anybody because all the weapons are so wildly inaccurate. I'm not sure that's true. I think that's just really badly designed.
It's certainly not that enjoyable. I kind of buy into Gapper's argument that it's all an expression of a single coherent vision then.
It's too buggy and broken for that to be the case. Like, there are so many hallmarks of a troubled or at least not heavily QA'd development process.
That's certainly true.
I'm suspect that I'm very suspicious that that is the vision that they came out with. But it's an interesting game. Like, the weird thing is you come away from that and it's not narratively satisfying, and Kane and Lynch are these kind of horrible assholes. Yeah. Who you never really want to spend any time with. But it's to the game's credit, like, that it feels like it's thrown the opportunity away. Like, at least it's set up the possibility of you being interested in these characters.
and then threw it away.
Yeah, but I mean, more so than other games. Like, I mean, it's not like you care about Marcus Fenix in any way. And yet, Kane and Lynch, or at least there's a good movie that hasn't, that they haven't made.
Good job failing.
They keep trying. Yeah.
Kai Morgan says, "Dearest crates of the Barony of Crow."
That is good.
This email is less a question and more of an explanation regarding the reasoning behind the naming of indie platformer 140, as discussed in last week's episode, and why I think its name is actually a fine one. The correct way to say its name is 140. Well, thank you. I already said it that way. It takes its name from the BPM, beats per minute, of dubstep. In a similar vein, drum and bass is often referred to as 170. This is not to be confused with the dubstep of the dubstep gun in Saints Row, or what is commonly referred to dubstep on the average radio station, your Skrillex, etc. The more common use of the name dubstep is an appropriation that happened much to the chagrin of a rather passionate underground scene that had their name effectively pinched from them to be used for something that sounds rather different. Thank God the game wasn't just called dubstep. The real dubstep tends to feature prominent deep bass lines and heavy halftime beats, and less crazy noise one-upmanship. This is why the music in 140 sounds the way it does. It's a chipified version of the original dubstep formula. If you pull up a BPM finding webpage or similar app and tap along with the soundtrack, you may find it steadily bops along to 140 BPM. I won't go on to write suggested listening to illustrate my point, as I fear I may have already come across as far too much of a music arsehole. I just wanted to clear this up, as I have seen a misunderstanding regarding its name crop up a few times on my internet travels, or see it simply never mentioned. The injustice! After writing the above, I guess I do have some questions. Does a name have to be understood to be a good one? Should it be accessible in some manner to convey the content of the game in an easily readable way? Or, ignoring the advice of your average marketing department, is it perhaps okay for a name to appeal to a smaller section of the game's potential audience, and even be purposefully vague? Basically, what makes a good name? Also,
Do you now think 140 is a good name? Does it really deserve to be on the indie games with a terrible names list? Doesn't it, at the very least, have a more interesting name than, say, Batman? Come on! P.S. In a bid to potentially avoid the now almost weekly embarrassment of Chris Thurston and his spectacular inability to pronounce names, you pronounce my name Kai. May your pods be cast forevermore. All the best, guys. Kai Morgan.
I think it's really interesting. I don't think that the key about naming games is their appeal, though. I mean, from at least our perspective, from a very functional perspective, being able to find your game using Google is one of the things that I really prize now in games.
It's your lookup handle.
And I don't think that's like... I know there's a segment of the indie game development community which sees having names which are either accessible via Google or just accessible full stop as being somehow kowtowing to, like, capitalist pressure. And I kind of disagree. Like, I just think you want people to play this thing, right? So you've got to be able to find it. And those people who've got to be able to find it have got to be able to remember the name. Having just numerals for your name is not very memorable. And although, obviously, there is this interesting dubstep link, I don't think most people can be aware of that instantaneously. And so it's just going to be difficult for them to find. Like, why
for
make
me,
it
like,
difficult?
The considerations when you're picking a name for the game is, when you tell someone this name before they know anything about the game, what do they know about the game now? Yeah. And 140, they still don't know a fucking thing about the game. Like, they don't know a single thing. Like, not even the genre or anything at all. And so I appreciate that it has this connection once you already understand what the game is and what the name is. And once you have both those pieces of information, you can draw a line between them. Do you now think 140 is a good name? No, I still don't think 140 is a good name.
I think, it doesn't... You don't need to have... I kind of disagree. I don't think you need to have game names that necessarily state exactly what's in the game. Like, I mean, there is room for some kind of vagueness or metaphor or all these other things that might get you away from the kind of raw mechanics. Like, they don't need to be totally descriptive. But I think you can actually, if you think really hard about it, come up with a name which is not only Google searchable, but is like an interesting metaphor. It does sound poetic in some way or whatever, and also does do some job of describing it. Like, it's not an impossible task.
Do we have any suggestions for, like, names that we like that are really good and that do all the things that we kind of think that good game names should?
My favorite name isn't very descriptive, and it's Grim Fandango, just because it's like, it doesn't matter what that game is. You just want to play it. Like, whatever, if it's a first-person shooter, sure, I'll play that. Like, if it's an RTS, I'll play that. But it's called Grim Fandango, which is just the best sequence of words ever.
I think Eldritch is a pretty good name.
Yeah.
I like it.
It gives
you
a nice vibe for it.
Yeah, Spelunky's a great name.
Yeah.
A really great name.
Winkmander.
Yeah, it is, actually.
Yeah. Easily such a
football manager.
That fucking gets to the point. You know what you're doing
there? I don't know. I think that's probably a bit vague. They could have really nailed that one down.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of big names. Just most game names are not that good. But I think in particular, my scorn is most reserved for fantasy games where they have the name of the fantasy kingdom in their name, such as Kingdoms of Amalur, I think is probably about the worst name I can think of. In that, like, not that it's the most offensive, like, it doesn't put me off more than, you know...
But it's just meaningless, isn't it? Like, you just read that as...
Yeah, it's literally all of the words negate themselves. Yeah. Like, kingdoms, I know what a kingdom is, of Amalur, I don't know what Amalur is, so now I don't know what the kingdom is. So now I'm back to square one.
Well,
there's zero information
tides
here.
Tides of Numenera.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
This is the worst example.
Why is it in the title? Why would it be in the title? That doesn't help you. There's no... Like, nobody who hears the title knows what the thing is yet.
Should have been called Fantasy Universe Punching Game. That would be much better.
What about Baldur's Gate? Is that a...
That's pretty bad, I think.
I don't really have perspective on that because it's such an icon now that it's hard for me to...
Maybe it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I mean, like, The Elder Scrolls 5 Skyrim. Or...
Yeah, 5.
Yeah. That's bad. There's no information in there.
Skyrim is...
It's not about scrolls.
But Skyrim
is...
It's
a fantasy game, I guess. Like, it's evocative.
Yeah,
it's
the same with Kingdom of Amalur, you know, it's a fantasy game.
Yeah, but Amalur is a made-up word, or at least Elder Scrolls are both...
Skyrim's...
And also, by the fifth game, you've bought your kind of fucking... I mean, you can do whatever you like.
Yeah, you've earned a certain amount of bullshit.
Yeah, but, first one was called Arena, which is quite good given it was an arena fighting game.
Yeah.
What about
Quake?
Looking at a magazine that happens to be on the table here, Tom Clancy's The Division.
No, see, I think fucking that's rubbish.
Yeah, I'd like,
I forget that all the time. Yeah, I'm really excited about the game. Yeah, and I'm always like, is it the club, the crew, the team? Because
there is a game called The Crew.
Yeah, I know. But like, there was one that announced at the same time, wasn't there? That was a similar kind of thing. Did you know, this is a bit of an aside, but there is someone whose job title is lead Tom Clancy writer.
Really?
It's
wow.
not Tom Clancy, it's somebody else. Their job is they are the lead writer on Tom Clancy projects. Anything that says it's by Tom Clancy, he's the lead writer on that, and he's not Tom Clancy.
Tom Clancy's lead Tom Clancy writer.
Yeah, I'm the king of things written by Tom Clancy. I've written all of the things written by Tom Clancy.
Man. Well, that guy is responsible for a whole lot of shit. Blacklist.
I think he's now outnumbered Star Wars is the most popular prefix for a game on Steam.
Really?
Tom Clancy. Like, Tom Clancy's X, there's like 35 of those, and I think there's like 25 Star Wars games.
I wonder if they'll, do you think they're going to remove that now that he's passed on to the,
they own his name.
Like, World Beyond?
Don't Ubisoft own
forever.
Yeah, but I don't know.
Death cannot save you now, Tom Clancy.
But was that actually a seal of approval by Tom Clancy? Was that what was valuable about it?
Or
is it like Colin McRae? Like, it was just a,
the latter, I think, I mean.
Because they ditched Colin McRae's name after he died, didn't they?
Mm. They phased it out gradually.
Mm. Michael Blatherwick asks, greetings, Cretan crowbars. Cretan as in people from Crete. If you had to choose a secret greeting for meeting somebody you didn't know, where one of you says one line and the other person has to reply with the correct response, what would you use? My answer to this is,
shall we gather for whiskey and cigars tonight?
What is the plot?
Indeed, I believe so.
Yes, okay. Mine would have been from Oblivion. I hear Arendelle is good with lockpicks. I've heard he's good with locks. That's one of the responses you can get for that. And it's video game dialogue is good for this because the response has to be something specific. It also has to be something that nobody would ever naturally say in a situation.
Oh yeah, well,
which happens to apply to almost all video game dialogue.
The alternative, obviously, you can answer with two lines to mine, which is obviously never doubt it. The alternative.
I
probably accept probably just rats as well.
The dude who says, "Think you'll get your own squad after last night?" Jesus Christ, everyone's getting their own squad. Like, there's no negative answer. They're all just, never doubt it. I believe so. I'm sure. Yeah. I think this will happen. Yes, indeed. Whatever. It's just like 50% of their workforce is getting their own squad after last night.
Maybe they're all just really arrogant. They're not getting their own squad. So they're just.
But their friends believe them. They're like, oh yeah, for sure. You're getting your own squad. No doubt, man. I also, every time I play that game, I want to gather for whiskey and cigars.
That's what I think of this podcast. Every time I send out the email,
I gather for whiskey and cigars.
Yeah.
Hello, Cretans and Crow Eaters. On Steam, many early access games.
Sorry, who says this?
Steve, sorry.
Oh, Steve.
Hello, Cretans and Crow Eaters. On Steam, many early access games cost less than they will when they are officially released. Some cost the same as release. But some, like Nuclear Throne, cost more for early access and will be cheaper when released. I emphasize that because he put them in bold. How do you feel about paying more for early access?
That kind of sucks. I didn't know that about Nuclear Throne, actually.
No, but the most amazing example of this is Planetary Annihilation, which cost £90 when it was first released in early access. Because they wanted to match their Kickstarter goals, and their Kickstarter goals is, hey, we should charge more money for the earlier access you get.
Yeah, they were forced into it, basically.
By themselves, I mean.
Well, if they'd charged any less, they would have been in lots of trouble after they'd done the Kickstarter, then they were forced by their own decision into it.
But I think it's basically unethical, I know that I'm sure market forces, supply and demand, obviously people want to get into games early and they may want that to a degree where they're willing to pay lots of money for it. It is still unethical for you to charge them that amount of money because you're asking them to beta test a game.
Yeah.
And you're asking them to pay to beta test your game. Mm. That is kind of
disgusting. Like already asking them to pay is a big deal, and then asking them to pay extra to do it is an extra big deal.
But
if your practical decision is, oh, we need to make money for this game and how's a way we can do that, like, as you say, it's true, people will pay it if you ask them because people are really desperate to play things now rather than later for some reason, which is weird to me. Like, I used to care about that, and then since making a game,
and sending out to early beta testers, I'm kind of like, as I send it out, I feel guilty. I'm like, sorry guys, you're kind of, I'm ruining the puzzles here for you, and you're going to play a shitty version of the game, and then when it does come out, like, even if you like it, you will know the puzzles, and so, like, I'm kind of ruining part of the final experience for you. Since doing that, I suddenly don't want to play any early access games, like, at Gamescom, I was like, oh, I could queue up and play Titanfall. No, if I'm excited about Titanfall, I think I'll just wait and play Titanfall. Like, waiting is not that hard. Playing an early version of something that's in a bad state can be really destructive to your experience.
Yeah, I don't mind that. I mean, I think I've been trained to enjoy the process behind games being made and seeing how all their kinks get worked out and all that stuff, just by doing the job that we've done. Like, I mean, you see games in terrible states before they get released and you have to have a sense of optimism about how they will, everything will come together. That's not a problem. It is simply asking people to pay for that I think is wrong. Like, you just can't really do that.
There's a big attitude that's like, well, people are willing to pay for it, so that's okay then.
Yeah, but that's
not... I think that as anyone who's selling something, you have an ethical obligation to make sure that what you are charging for what you're selling is what you would pay for it. Like, it's a thing you think is worth it. Well, and so if you charge them £80 to play your game in a really unfinished state, I think you have to ask yourself, is that actually what I think this is worth? Because you're kind of, just by offering that, you are saying, if you trust me, if you think I am a good person, then you believe me that this is worth that amount of money. And exactly. If it's not worth that amount of money, then you're betraying that trust and you are deceiving people into giving you money. And I think, actually, weirdly, Chris Taylor is one of the most kind of responsible people who ever did the Kickstarter. Like, he felt really fucking bad about it. Like, he didn't offer any really high priced rewards. It was like, past a certain point, he just didn't offer any like really high ones. And then someone persuaded him to offer like one particular high tier reward. But the people that, like, on any given Kickstarter, you will find it, you can pay $10,000 to have lunch with the person who made it. And you're like, do you really think your lunch is worth $10,000? Because I know some of these people, and they don't. Like, they don't think their lunch is worth $10,000. They don't think they're super self-important and, massively
worthwhile.
Yeah,
I mean, it's the same thing with, like, whales and gambling. Like, I mean, that's a disgusting term.
If you're desperate.
To talk about people, like, who are kind of chemically addicted to gambling, basically. And that's a terrible
thing. If you're literally desperate, and it's this or you starve to death, then okay.
Well, maybe you can
do what you have to do to survive. But like, if this is the thing that, if it doesn't work out, you'll just go back to your normal job and you'll carry on making a living and still surviving, doing a thing that you're less excited about, then it's not right to sort of say, like, nah, I'm going to charge you $10,000 to have lunch with me.
What do you think of the argument that some developers make that the reason they charge a higher price for Alpha Access is that they're trying to put people off from buying it?
Come
on.
But if they charge 10 quid...
They won't put people off, don't offer it.
If they think if they charge 10 quid, they'll get 10,000 people buying it, and some of those people will be more casual people that have just stumbled into it and will have a bad experience. Whereas if they charge 30, then you're only appealing to your core.
There are many other ways you can appeal to your core than just simply charging a fuck ton of money.
And you can do a closed beta. That's what, at gunpoint, they did a closed beta, and it was free. You don't pay anything at all, and I just take on as many people as I can handle the feedback from, and then I'm not charging you. I still feel guilty because I'm giving you an early version of the game that I think in some sense spoils some of the effect of the final game. But if you have voluntarily signed up and said, yes, I really, really want an early version of this game, then I don't feel too bad about giving it to you. But to charge you money for it and to charge you extra for it, to charge you like $50 instead of like $10, it would be so gross.
I agree with you. But you like Nuclear Throne.
I do like Nuclear Throne. I think it's actually probably worth the amount of money that it is, but only just. Like, it is quite expensive for what it is.
Yeah.
Well, how much is it right now?
That's like $12?
$12.
Oh, that's fine. I think it's worth $12.
Oh, yeah. All right, money bags.
$12 is not that bad. Like, if it is 25 or something, then I would...
No. It's a fairly simple game for what it is, but you hope that it expands in some way. The idea.
Well,
that
I'm not close
ever...
to getting to the end of it, so I'm like, I'm dying on level 3 or something. So if there's 7 levels, then I'm happy.
So basically, you're saying that the only thing that redeems early access conceptually is if the game you're putting out is good, and if you put out a game and it's bad, then it's unethical.
No, I'm saying that.
I think I'm saying that.
But if you look at games which have done early access and Days of Yore, like Minecraft or Mountain Blade. What they did was that they offered the games really cheaply and then incrementally increased the payment dependent on the value of the game that they then assess. I mean, like, that's not a difficult point. Like, that seems like just obvious. That's what you would do. And that's very reasonable. Charging people like the price for a full game, pretty much like space, whatever the number it is at the end of that
DF9. As
charging
Deep Space
20, 20?
Or Dwarf Fortress 9.
Or Double Fine 9.
Double Fortress Space 9.
Charging the money they do for a game which is nowhere near being even vaguely finished, or even really a game at this stage, is, that's not right, man. It's just not right.
Not cool, bro.
And the idea that you can just say, oh, but people are willing to pay it, to pay for it. You're like, well, you know, you can lie and get people to give you money. That doesn't, obviously so, yeah. There's a line exactly. Somewhere that you can draw, right?
Yes. I mean, that's a very good point. none of us are saying that, like, just if you could say something and someone gives you money for it, that makes it right to say that thing. That's not true. That isn't true. That is not a way to behave. But, like, to cut a bit closer to the bone, I think, you know, Introversion have always charged $30 at least for Prison Architect. It's always been the $30 or more.
Mm.
And the first time I played it wasn't remotely worth $30, I don't think. And maybe, I mean, there were certainly a lot of people willing to pay that. There were enough people willing to pay that they made $1 million before they even launched on Steam. But at the stage I played it, it wasn't a game that was worth $30. I would not recommend it. If I had to review it at $30 in that state, I would give it like 40% or something. It would be like, no, this is a frustrating, confusing, weird game. A lot of the systems don't work yet. Seems exciting. I'd like to see it, you know, grow into something cool, but don't pay $30 for it. I strongly recommend you don't do that. That's a bad decision. And they offered that decision and people did it and they got that money. And I'm not that sad about that because I think Introversion were struggling at that point and it really turned around for them and suddenly they're a company that are successful and they can do what they like and Prison Architect will turn into a cool game. But
yeah, they're kind of a weird special case because they are obviously really an interesting company that will go on to make great games if they have the freedom to do so, and this obviously has done that. So you can retrospectively say, well, that was a great thing, but I don't really approve of the practice.
Yeah, I'd love to like just talk to the first 100 purchasers of that game and just say, were you totally satisfied with it? And if the game ends up being developed to the point where it is worth $30, in that kind of game, I think it makes more sense because if they eventually make a really rich simulation that is worth $30, I think the guys who bought it when it was not worth that will still get the value from the final thing. Whereas with Gunpoint, one of the reasons I didn't want to do it, like, purchased Alpha Access is because it's a linear, fixed length story game, and if you have finished it once, then the polished version when it's out is not worth that much to you. It's like, it'll be better, but it won't be, because you've experienced that stuff before, it'll be spoiled for you a bit. Whereas Prison Architect is totally freeform, totally sandbox, so even if you experience the shitty version that was the very first version of Prison Architect they ever released, the final version will still be really worth a lot to you. It'll be like, now it's worth $30, and I only ever pay $30, so that's good.
I think those people get more out of it, because I think there is real pleasure in watching a thing grow and expand and being a part of that process. So the people who got in early, I think, get more for their 30 quid than the people who just jump on the end and get the finished product for 30
Maybe,
quid.
Maybe, eventually.
But it is dependent on the game continuing to develop over 3 or 4 years, which is a thing
kind of unguaranteed as well. Like, I mean, they're also making a risk there, which probably equally counteracts the benefit that they get.
Mm.
You know what I mean? They are taking a risk.
They're taking a gamble, they're investing in a thing, but it can be fun to invest in a thing. Like, assuming you get rewarded for it, obviously. But, like, it's not uniformly bad. And,
the voice of Wall Street. It's fun to invest! How about some subprime mortgages?
Fabian A. Scherschel says, apparently EA is losing money now. How the fuck do they manage that with all their high-grade IP?
Yeah, I think it's whenever you hear of a company losing money in a particular year, it's always best to hold off from posting angrily on Twitter about it, because companies write off losses during a period of time, so they may have invested heavily in a number of projects, which will mean that they will be in a deficit for the next few years, but then they'll make that money back when those games are released. So it's difficult to tell.
There's a new console about to launch.
Yeah.
There's not many games coming out at the moment.
And they're all pouring money into the development.
EA are about to launch the next gen FIFA, which is like a completely different game from the current one, and the new NBA franchise that they've got, NBA Live 14,
also,
and
sure,
then like February next year, Titanfall comes out, I think.
Whatever quarter this is can't take into account the sales of Battlefield, which have just been released, which is obviously probably their biggest launch this year so far.
Chris Kinneberg says, clearly the CNC crew has plenty of alcohol-related experience. What's your favourite in-game inebriation experience, and what's your favourite game to play intoxicated? Tom Cena, you have...
I was going to talk about Diablo 3 when I was really drunk and playing it at like 2 a.m. or something on Friday night, got back from the pub, and ended up playing with a friend's friend who I'd never met before, who was also extremely drunk, and also incredibly powerful, like the most powerful character I've ever seen. And he was also a barbarian like me. And he just gave me, like, the most powerful equipment in the game. Just drops it on the floor and said, look, have it. There it is. It's all yours. That way we can fight together, and we can have fun together. And it was a really nice altruistic kind of session with a man I'd never met, and it was mostly because we were both intoxicated and, in a very huggy, happy state, and killed monsters together. And then he just let me keep all of that stuff, and kind of broke the game, really. Because,
then he ruined the game forever for me.
He short-circuited the reward loop of Diablo by just giving me the best stuff straight away. So,
he broke the prime directive of Diablo.
Yes, he did.
Like,
did
not give civilization
to noobs.
Yeah.
British Ferret says, have you ever tried a game thinking, I'm going to hate this, but then enjoying it, or the other way around? I have flagged the question as if I have an answer to it. And yet as I read it now, I can't recall.
Fine, we can cut this.
I'm going to hate this. And then I end up enjoying it. Nope. I got nothing. I mean, I played Football Manager, but then I didn't enjoy it. So that doesn't count.
You didn't like Splunky when you first played it?
Well, yeah. Well, I didn't... Yeah, I guess I was sceptical of that. And then also Rise of Nations, I thought was going to be awful because it was... it was like it's an RTS, but it's historical, but also it's not, like, accurate. It's, you know, you start up with, like, cavemen, and then you rise up through tanks and then, like, nukes and stuff within the course of a half-hour game. And so I just thought, like, it's going to be boring because it's real world, but then also not realistic because it's not real world. But then the actual tutorial for that game is so incredibly good that I was just totally sold on it by the end of the tutorial because it just... tells you what to do, but then if you do something else, it tells you about that instead. So it says, like, hey, build 2 workers. And I didn't build 2 workers. I kept on my scout and sent them into the wilderness. And, like, oh, your scout has increased vision range. You just send him over here and here and here, and he can do these other things, and, like, here are his abilities. And I'm like, what? You're responding to what I did? And I click on my town hall. Like, oh, this is your town hall. You can do this and this and this. Like, what? This is crazy. You're giving me help with what I'm trying to do, and you're not shouting at me for not doing what you said I should do. And so just through tutorial, that became like an awesome game. And then I, you know, played those games forever. I played Civ and I played Rise of Legends and...
I'd say, Uplink, which is a game where I didn't understand how it could be fun when I started playing it. Uplink's the Introverted's first game, I think. It's about being a hacker and, deploying kind of viruses and things and, routing signals through hubs across the world in order to hack into banks and that kind of stuff. But it's just a series of menu screens and, I had no idea how it was going to generate tension or interest until I started playing it and actually moving those boxes around against a time limit, knowing that someone's trying to trace your hack and you've got to activate certain countermeasures within a certain amount of time. It became incredibly tense. And all I was doing was staring at these boxy screens with lines going from one port to another, like freaking out about, you know, the fact I've got to disconnect this node before someone traces me back to my hometown. And,
I think, Clash of Heroes was that experience for me. I know I bang on about that game all the time, but I think when I got given it, I think I was given it to review on Edge, I was like, oh, fucking hell. It was part of the Might and Magic franchise, which is one of the kind of most guffballs looking snorefests of all time.
The most guffball snorefest.
Yeah, and like this promised to be like a kiddie manga version of a guffball snorefest. I was like, Jesus Christ. And then, within, like, 5 minutes when it first said, you've been given bears. And these bears kind of just become, like, these flaming balls of fire that then power through. I was just like, yeah, okay, this is pretty great.
Flaming bears.
And it became, like, my favourite game.
Cool.
Yeah.
Tectonic asks, hello, Crowbards. How do you write? With a regular schedule? How much do you revise? Does practice help? Cheers and thanks! So it depends how much you care, but when I had a really important review or something on PC Gamer, I would write it, just as it came to me, and just write a draft, and then I would kind of tweak it a bit, and then I would, once I had something I thought was kind of getting towards what I wanted, I tried reading it aloud to myself in the evening. So I'd be writing during the day and my day job, and then I'd go home, and then I'd take a printout with me, and I would read it through on the bus, and then when I got home, I'd read it aloud and record myself reading it aloud. And when you read something aloud, you often discover that it's not written that well. The flow of it, the sound of it, it makes sense to you in your head because you wrote it. And so you, whatever flow that happens in your brain can kind of skim over any problems with it. But when you have to say it in words, sometimes you hit really big problems with oh shit, this sentence is really awkward to say, or this, the rhythm of this is really off. And it forces you to cut those bits out and make it sound good. And, also just rethink what you said and just realize, I spent a lot of time talking about this point and that's not that important. And then after that, I would whittle it down and change it fairly dramatically based on that.
Good advice.
Yeah.
Always read out aloud the work you've written. That is such an obvious thing, but it is so obvious that almost no journalists appear to do it based on the copy that's been submitted to me over the years.
I write with a glass of red wine staring into the heart of a thunderstorm.
Yes.
What happens if there isn't one?
I write with a typewriter on a deserted skeletal oil rig in the middle of the North Sea. Yeah, the thing about writing is it's not romantic activity at all. It's about sitting on your own in your own little world, trying to twist, like Tom says, thoughts that are very obvious to you, and trying to imagine someone else reading it and coming at it for the first time, and that kind of experience they can get out of it. And it's actually, it's not like a zen state or anything, you just have to fucking bash it out. It's amazing. And there are deadlines, or if you're writing news, it's going to be quick.
I do find it, you can choose how much you want to put into a given piece. And so if something I really care about and I really want to do a good job of it, I start from the premise of if it's a review, what might the best possible review of this game be like? I'm not going to achieve that, but if I start from that's my goal, then I will at least try and go a bit further than the standard thing. I'll always figure out how could this be better than just the general review? I guess it could be.
How many
funny,
guns
maybe?
Does it have? Does it have crates? How big are the levels?
How do you get past that? How do you get past just writing the sort of standard response to it? Because there are, we review games, the biggest reviews are of games that 500 different people will review. There will be 500 reviews out there, and they will all fucking say a lot of the same shit. They will, just because they have to, there's a certain amount of factual information that has to be the same. And so if you want to, pick an angle that's going to be immediately interesting and unusual and different, but still honest and still accurate. That's tricky. And it's never going to be trivial to do that for everything. But if you've decided, shit, this is the review of Deus Ex Human Revolution, it needs to start with a sentence that is not going to be the same sentence as every other review of Deus Ex Human Revolution. It needs to start with something that's personal to me or something. Or, something that happened to me when I was playing or something that was really illustrative of the way the mechanics work. Then you just have to, the trickiest step is just taking that first step of saying, I want to make this different. It has to be not just the standard intro, it has to be something else.
We should always write, because that's the most honest thing, isn't it? To write something that's personal to you, but never make the mistake of then writing about yourself.
Yeah.
That line is very easy to cross, and lots of people do it, and I despise those people. I wish only death upon them.
Creators of Snorefests.
Yeah.
The instigators.
Yep. That is it for questions. So I think we should wrap it up there.
We should do. If you have any other questions, you can email us at questions@creightoncrowbar.com. Or, indeed, you can tweet us at creightoncrowbar. That's on the Twitters. Or you can tweet us individually. I'm at Marsh Davies. That's DAVIES.
I am at Pentadact. That's PNTADACT.
I'm at PCG Ludo, which is LUDO.
And I am at Gonnas, GONNAS.
Thanks for listening, everybody!
Oh my god.